This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're talking about language, writing, and speaking, we all toggle between two different worlds. There's the formal world, where there are words written in articles and emails and words spoken in speeches and news reports, but that's not the real world. No one talks or writes to their friends or coworkers like they're giving a speech or writing a paper. That happens in the other world, the one where we all live and hang out. The linguist Gretchen McCulloch says they're different genres, really, and these styles, the lingo and the slang, are always changing when the times change or when technology changes. McCulloch is not just any linguist, she's an internet linguist, and she studies how the internet is changing the way we communicate. She gave us an example about how these genres change over time. If you're a kid in high school today, you text, but not so long ago, you passed notes.
The genre that texting belongs to is an interesting sort of genre because you have this back and forth conversation in writing. And it doesn't have a lot of offline analogs because how are you going to pass a piece of paper back and forth in essentially real time in a situation where you couldn't just talk? But one of the real, you know, face-to-face analogs that it does have is passing notes. So if you're in class or if you're in a meeting and you want to be talking to somebody else, but the meeting is still going on or the class is still going on and you're still supposed to be paying attention, so you can't just whisper to them, you might pass notes with this person. You sit beside a friend and you have like one sheet of notepaper just kind of in between you. And every so often you just sort of lean over and you write something. And then you lean back and pretend to be paying attention to class. And then the other person leans over and writes something else. Then you end up with this piece of paper that turns into kind of like a chat transcript, but in analog form.
Pass it on.
Two. To Tim.
Yeah. Okay.
Chelsea, Allie, what are you doing?
What I noticed when I was doing this in school is that sometimes I would hand write a smiley face because I wanted to convey that sort of thing that a smiley face conveys. I wanted to convey the kind of thing that LOL conveys. I didn't do this in my class papers because that's not the kind of genre where you wanted to use a smiley face. In this context that's very much like an instant messaging or chat conversation, I wanted to use these same sorts of tools even though they'd originated in the digital realm.
And McCulloch says that's how language works. All of us working within the context of the moment, using the tools at hand. But sometimes the wires get crossed because some of us are better at using the tools of the internet era than others. And this is why your college-aged kid or your granddaughter thinks you're throwing shade when you end a text with a period. The fact is, if you're fully punctuating your texts, there's a good chance your kids think it's either weird or adorable, but not cool or even necessary. Gretchen McCulloch's new book is called Because Internet, and in it she explores how language is changing. She's not worried about it, by the way. She's like most linguists when they talk about the way language changes. They're pretty zen. This change isn't good or bad. It just is. And language is always changing.
The way that I think about language, which is the way that a lot of linguists, probably all linguists really, think about language, is that language is something that's part of the human brain and the human society. And we know that, you know, human things don't just stay in one spot, you know? We keep evolving, we keep changing, culture changes, society changes because it's alive and because it lives in the minds of living humans. And so it would be weird and ahistorical to expect that language would be this strange anomaly of a human phenomenon that never changes. You know, clothing fashions change and food styles change and all of these things change. And that's fine. You know, sometimes people are a little bit grumpy, but no one's like, oh, man, we're not wearing togas anymore.
Right, right.
So, and yet, oh, no, we're not speaking Latin anymore or we're not speaking English the way the good old days. Like, somehow that's different. It's not different. It's the same thing. You know, we don't talk like Shakespeare did. And in 500 years, people aren't going to talk like we did. Whether or not any new technology gets invented, it's still every language always changes a little bit going on from one generation to the next. And that's actually what makes it really strong. Because if you had to pass down the exact same thing in order for language to exist at all, then there'd be this worry that it could be lost. You know, sometimes ancient techniques for architecture or art get lost because they, you know, no one transmits how to make that Roman style of concrete. But language doesn't get lost because every generation can pick it up because they change it a little bit. And that's what makes it sort of robust and flexible. It's amazing that language changes, and it's impressive and it's exciting that language changes. And to think otherwise is just to kind of project our own insecurities onto the form of the language.
The beginning of the book, you really focus on writing to help us understand how we got to this new kind of language. And you explain how writing kind of worked on this continuum. At first, the systems of writing that we had were aware of their limitations. And at first, they were only words. But then eventually, we added some punctuation. And eventually, we began to see writing as a thing that could represent, as you say, verbatim speech. We didn't think it would be that at first, but then that came to be that. And so now we're at the internet, and you describe the internet as maybe the final key in this continuum, in this process?
I mean, it's probably arrogant of me to say it's the final key. You know, that's 21st century arrogance, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Probably somebody in the 23rd century is going to say, but of course, now we have this thing, which is also very helpful. So, you know, with the chauvinism of our own century, that's probably saying that does. But I think the internet does provide a very interesting key at that point. Because, so if you think about the old records that we find on clay tablets and scrolls and these kinds of things, they're often sort of administrative records, you know, this person, you know, donated this, you know, sold this many cows to this other person for this much grain. They're not so much people's like journals or their hopes and fears. They're a lot more, you know, they might be their prayers to the gods to, you know, cure their, I don't know, diseases and these kinds of things. But they're not so much like, you know, the sort of hopes and fears and dreams and aspirations in the very earliest senses of writing.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, we use the idea that writing can convey a tone of voice, which is, you know, something that I think some people are still having difficulty with, that when you send someone a text message, you can tell if they're being passive aggressive or if they're being angry or if they're just like slightly annoyed, but like not too annoyed, but just like a little bit annoyed.
Yeah.
Or if they're cold or they're friendly or something like this, these sorts of subtleties. I think that's something that we're still grappling with at this level. And I think it's very exciting that we can more fully convey tone of voice, because I still see some people complaining, oh, well, you could never truly get tone of voice in writing. And yet, with many of my friends that I communicate with on the internet, I do know what they're thinking about the words that they're saying. And we are communicating that with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in a few more generations, the idea that you couldn't infer tone of voice from writing will seem like this bizarre historical thing, because already half of the people are doing it. And I think we're getting a lot out of it. So I don't know why you'd want to stop having that fuller, richer sort of thing.
Yeah, because the writing, as you say, in the past used to be a kind of lifeless thing. Now it's taken on, well, it's been imbued with life. It's been imbued with expression and tone. And we're creating our own rules for all of this. It's an exciting thing, not something to be afraid of, I guess.
Exactly. And the idea that the idea that writing was trying to convey, you know, tone or trying to convey feeling, that used to be sort of the job of the novelist or the poet.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying we can't still have poets. Like, well, that's great. But you shouldn't have to be as good as a poet. You shouldn't have to be as good as a novelist, a professional writer, in order to be able to express yourself in an ordinary sort of way in writing. You know, you don't need to be a professional public speaker in order to have a conversation. So this idea that writing only belongs to professionals, or that the only good type of writing is a professional type of writing, of course you can still have professional writers. I read books all the time. But that doesn't mean that all writing has to be professional writing, or that all people have to be professional. And I think that speech is an interesting way to look at that, because we know, we've had for a long time, for, you know, the extent of human memory and human history, we know that there have been formal and informal genres of speech. If you think of those epic poems, you know, the Iliad, the Odyssey, Beowulf, these types of things, they come to us from an oral tradition. And then eventually they get written down as that oral tradition is dying out. But they started out as these long things that people memorized and delivered in slightly different versions to large audiences. And that was a big thing that people did. That some cultures that still have that oral memory still do. And so we know, but of course people weren't having conversations in iambic pentameter or whatever, right, you know? Right. Yeah. Like at the time, like this meter was to make it this sort of stylized thing. And so we know that speech can exist in multiple registers. We know that just because someone's a good conversationalist doesn't make them a good public speaker. We know that the desirable traits of a good conversationalist and a good public speaker aren't necessarily the same. Like, you want a conversationalist to be interactive, whereas a public speaker gets to hold the floor for a longer time and these kinds of things. And so this idea that writing can have formal and informal versions, it can have varieties of style depending on the situation. And there doesn't have to be just like one good thing, like the one version that your English teacher liked. It's fine if your goal is to impress your English teacher, but there are lots of other goals you can have, and it's reasonable to do different things to accomplish them.
So in some ways, has it empowered normal people to be expressive, to, you know, if you strip away the formality and the intimidation of a blank page and you are able to just text or write a blog post or an email that is deeply informal, it seems like there's the potential for more creativity, more, and maybe even stripping away class lines as well.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm really excited about, because I think that, you know, if you think about how much easier the means of production have gotten in terms of writing, you know, you don't have to own a printing press to disseminate that. You don't even have to own a photocopier. You just need to own this device that you can use already to consume media, is also a device you can use to create media. You know, you can have a tweet that goes viral even if you're some teenager in a bedroom. And that's really cool. And it gives, you know, ordinary people this kind of access to making an impact on the world and saying things that other people can hear and finding people that their messages resonate with and these kinds of things. And I don't think that, like, I think that this idea that, you know, here's this one right way to write was always this sort of very aristocratic, elitist form of doing so. And never has anybody had that kind of access to elite education or, you know, wanted to do that. Like, it was a certain sort of dynamic. You know, why do we need to write in a way that appeals to dead people? They're not here to appreciate it. You know, we could write in ways that appeal to the living people we actually see. Why not try to connect with them rather than the people that aren't even around anymore?
So it's about connection. That's a big part of this.
I think it's about connection. I think that a lot of people have been sort of sold this false bill of goods that says, if you write in this certain way, you'll be doing things right and you'll feel good about how right you are. But what they've actually been sold is a way, writing is a way of demonstrating intellectual superiority. Language is a way of demonstrating intellectual superiority. And I think that's, it's just a sad way to live.
Yeah.
Because you could use language as a way of being kind and compassionate to people and not getting hung up about whether it's correct, but thinking about whether it's kind, thinking about whether it's being read the way you intended it to be, or whether you accidentally used a word that you didn't realize was a slur and that you don't actually want to be insulting people. And so you do want to change that because you want to be kind with language. Why not use language as a way of connecting with people rather than making them feel bad?
It's interesting. I read where you had, I think you were really young. You were like 12, and you picked up this book that was a book about pop linguistics, and you were captivated by it. So it seems like from a very early age, you've been thinking about the way we communicate in popular culture. What is it about you?
I mean, I wish I knew. I think one of the things about language that makes it really fascinating is that it's always there. You know, it's you know, I can't turn the linguist part of my brain off. And I think a lot of linguists feel this way because there are so many situations where the linguist part of your brain is relevant. You know, so you know, if you're having a conversation with someone, and I'm like, I'm really trying to listen to the content of what you're saying, but I just noticed you pronounced that word in this interesting sort of way, or like, I'm just kind of analyzing your vowels. You know, sometimes I'll meet somebody new, and at the end of the evening, I'll be like, oh yeah, so I have a little accent report on this person. Like, they lived here, and then they lived here, and then they lived here, and here's how you can see those things show up, or something like that. You're always using language. It's really hard to go through a day without using language, without encountering language. And so there's always something there to analyze. There's always something there to be captivated by. And especially once you start looking at it, there are, you know, real patterns there that other people have looked into and figured out. And so sometimes you can just go look them up, or you try to look them up and you're like, oh, no one's actually looked into this. And I think it's like, you know, if you're a biologist or something and you're walking down the street, and where the rest of us just see sort of trees, or just see sort of plants, an undifferentiated green wall of plants, you're seeing, okay, this is an oak, and this is a juniper, and this is a, you know, here are all the plants. Like, I'm not a biologist. I just see a green wall of plants. But I assume that, you know, where other people see this sort of, you know, massive wall of language, of like, oh, it's all just sort of this murky thing, a linguist is looking into it and saying, oh, this is this phenomenon that I can link to something that I know about. You know, it's probably very satisfying to know this about plants. And I know it's very satisfying to have this sort of knowledge about language.
You write about how language works. That's part of what you deal with in the book, and how we came to talk the way we do. It's an interesting part of the book. And I wanted to ask you a few things about that. One thing that was really interesting to me is that when it comes to linguistic change over the years, you say it's often women who lead the way. Why is that, do you think?
Well, the finding that it's often women that lead change is very well attested. The reason why is still something that's under active investigation. You know, there are some theories. One theory is that because in the societies studied, women tend to dominate child caring, even if the men are doing a more advanced linguistic change, they're less likely to pass it down. Another vein of thought finds that if women on average tend to have larger social networks, they could be exposed to more potential sources of linguistic innovation and also have more ways of transmitting those. You know, there, or you could find that if women generally have less power in society, they maybe feel more pressure to change their language to keep up with some sort of, you know, ability to do things. It's, you know, there's still a variety of proposals, and it's not quite clear which or perhaps several of them are the case.
There's this section in the book where you explain how we make these linguistic decisions and where we have over time. Sometimes we align ourselves with the upper class in the way we choose to say certain words, certain ways. And sometimes we choose to align ourselves with a lower class. Say something about this part. I thought this was really interesting because it seems like these days maybe younger people are more willing to align themselves with the language of their region or of a so-called lower class than people of another generation.
What we know is that younger people are often looking for ways to sort of differentiate themselves from their parents a bit, or to have a certain level of rebellion, or, you know, just to be a bit different. So, you know, or trying to rebel against authority. I mean, and you think of kids, you know, sneaking out of school and cutting class and, you know, hanging out around the back bleachers or something like this. This isn't particularly new. They do this linguistically, too. If you can talk in a way that your parents and teachers don't necessarily approve of, you can show that you're not beholden to them. So that's one factor. Another thing is it's easy to assume. It's often assumed in people who have this sort of naive view of language that, like, well, obviously everyone wants to align themselves with the upper classes and speak as correctly as possible. But this isn't true for a whole bunch of other domains, right? So people don't always want to dress as fancily as possible. People don't always want to eat only fancy food. So people use language as well to align themselves with groups of people they want to be friends with. Or want to show solidarity with. So if you want to talk like your friends, your classmates, or local people from your region, because you want to show that you fit in, that you belong, you're part of that, and you don't think you're too good for yourself, that is also a totally reasonable, you know, way of making decisions, that you want to seem like you're part of a group. It's something that humans do all the time.
I wonder, is the internet stripping out regional quirks in language? Are there still regionalisms going to be apparent in the way we interact just with internet language?
So you can't have both of these things, right? You can't say, you know, the kids are doing regional varieties more and also the internet is not doing it. But I think there is still regional variation on the internet. There are some really interesting studies of Twitter regional variation, because some people, a certain percentage of people, it's not very high, geotag their location in all of their tweets. So you can see from all their tweets where they're tweeting them from. And if you take enough of these and you make a big map of them, you can find that certain areas use certain words more often than other areas. So, for example, you can see, you know, in California, people saying hella. In Pittsburgh, I think it's, you get people saying yins. In various areas, you can see certain regional expressions popping up, and you can see them sometimes getting shifting from one location to another. So as something can get adopted by another group, it can become more popular as well. And these sorts of, you know, Twitter-based dialect maps do suggest that people keep using their own regionalisms on social media. And there are also specific studies of things like Scottish English, which has its own sets of spellings. And people use those on social media as well to sort of indicate their own local identity. And sometimes people switch back and forth depending on what they're trying to indicate in a given tweet or in a given message, saying, okay, like, here's me trying to, like, stake a claim to be a member of this local community, and then here's me trying to do this other thing that participates in a global community. So a lot of people are sensitive to this. But this has been a worry since very early days, that the rise of media in various forms would lead to the demise of local accents. And one of these was, you know, some of the early dialect studies in the 1800s were worried that newspapers would kill the local accent. And then there was a worry in the, you know, mid-1900s that radio or television would kill the local accent. And now it's like, maybe the internet's going to kill the local accent. And, you know, it turns out the local accents are surprisingly robust. And, you know, 200 years after newspapers have been introduced, they're still going strong. So I don't think that the internet is going to be that one sort of death knell for the local accent. So it's a... because a lot of cases, especially in terms of how we talk, we learn that from the people that we interact with a lot, and they are disproportionately local. You know, you may pick up specific words from the internet, but in terms of how you pronounce things, you're going to pick that up from a more, you know, the type of people you're actually listening to, and those are still disproportionately in a local community.
Gretchen McCulloch. Her new book is Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream, enjoy podcasts like Radio West and Preach, browse local news, and access our 24/7 streams of BBC World Service and classical music. You can also use the new Station Finder tool to locate the KUER radio frequency that's closest to you. And if you have CarPlay in your vehicle, our app is now compatible. The KUER mobile app is available for iPhone and Android wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio Westenberg for Fabrizio. Today in the program, the internet linguist Gretchen McCulloch is with us, explaining how it is the internet is changing our language. Some of the stuff she gets at in her book is why emoji became so popular and what's the deal with how people punctuate their text messages so differently. The book is called Because Internet. I think there's this sense that it's laziness that explains some of the language we see on the internet, especially, you know, by young people. But there's this interesting survey you mention in the book by these Canadian linguists where they examined the instant messaging conversations, I think it was like 71 teenagers. And you mentioned what they found was that teens weren't actually using internet slang all that much, that they were mixing informal language with very formal language, and which made me think that this isn't about laziness, it's about a particular type of expression.
Exactly. So this is a study by Sally Tagliamonte and Derek Dennis, and they looked at these real instant messaging conversations. And I really like this because there is so much hype about instant messaging. You know, I was when I was younger, the thing people everybody fear mongered about instead of emoji was the acronyms. Remember the acronyms in the earlier days of the internet? Like these kids with their LOL and their OMG and their WTF. And now they're still around, but the kind of acronym fear-mongering has simmered back around, and now everyone's fear-mongering about emoji instead. And it's like, and you'd always see these newspaper articles or whatever that would end up inventing these sort of outlandish and ridiculous acronyms. Like, so many acronyms, SMA. And you're like, no one says this. But I always thought as a teenager, like, maybe I'm just not cool enough. Maybe the problem is me. And maybe some cooler teenagers out there who, like, listen to MTV more. Maybe they're actually using this many acronyms. And so reading this Tagliamonte and Dennis study was very validating to me because it was like, oh, no. My friends were actually doing the typical thing. It was the media that was wrong. And this is why when you have, you know, sort of like network television executives writing representations of teen speak in teen movies or teen TV shows, they often ring false because they're just kind of throwing in all of these exotic trappings of teen speak, whether that's too many emoji or too many acronyms, and not paying attention to the more subtle context in which they're used because they're so excited by these exotic things that they're not willing to accept the more subtle forms that are more realistic. And they're not consulting people who are actually from the group in question. They're just sort of presenting this as like, well, I know my kid uses emoji all the time, so I must therefore make all the messages entirely in emoji. And they're like, no, teens don't actually do that. Have you looked at some data? So there's this tendency to sensationalize the kind of small representations of whatever's new and sort of exaggerate them into a caricature of what the language actually sounds like. And what I appreciated about the Tagliamonte Dennis study is that they looked at real data that they got from people who were willing to donate archives of their text messages and instant messaging conversations before the study started. So they weren't influenced by the observer effect, but people had consented. And they found that in addition to people saying things like so with lots of O's, which seems pretty internet-y, it's a creative respelling, they also said things like very, which you think of very as a pretty ordinary word, but if you listen to conversations among young people, you're unlikely to hear somebody saying, I'm very tired. You're more likely to hear, I'm so tired. And there's been other work on this that shows it's really not that common in speech at all in the younger couple decades.
So it's not formal or informal, it's its own genre. You say
it's its own genre, and it's doing its own things. And to do it correctly, or to do it in a way that sounds authentic to people who are part of that group, requires a sophisticated understanding that isn't necessarily apparent if you're outside of that group.
Yeah, let's talk about emoji. I thought this was interesting. You're right about how emoji caught on pretty quickly, but then it raised this question: why did it take so long to figure out a way to write our gestures? When in fact it turned out we've always tried to do this, I guess.
Yeah. If you look into the history of the desire for a sarcasm or irony punctuation mark, There are proposals for an ironic punctuation mark dating back to 1575. You know, and every century or less thereafter, you get someone else saying, you know, it would be really great, be a way of conveying irony in writing. Here's my proposal. And they don't catch on, and they don't catch on, and they don't catch on for 500 years. And yet with the internet, when we're put in a context where instead of kind of abstract sort of proposals from people who are relatively authoritative, you actually put the writing in the hands of a lot of ordinary people, then suddenly you get this whole explosion in terms of ironic punctuation marks, or in terms of ways to convey gestures or ways to convey tone of voice. And emoji require a certain amount of technical implementation. You know, they need to be approved by the people in charge of your phone. But the idea that we're using them to, you know, to substitute for gestures or to express the kinds of things that we would have otherwise expressed in gestures, we didn't have to use emoji for that purpose. You could have used them for a whole bunch of things. They're just little pictures by themselves. It's the fact that we kind of collectively arrived at this realization that the gestures that we wish we could express are expressible as emoji. That's what makes them really interesting to me, that people do have an emergent practice of like, here's what emoji are really for. And the way that they're often used looks very gestural when you in terms of like what we use gestures for is very similar to what we use emoji for. Mm.
You say emoji didn't succeed because they were a language. They succeeded because they weren't a language.
Yeah, it turns out it's really hard to learn a new language. You know, many people find it very difficult and frustrating, and, you know, it takes years. And if we wanted to use emoji, it's also difficult to learn how to read, for example. It takes children several years to do this. It's very difficult to be an illiterate adult. Languages are, you know, very complex, and they have lots of moving parts, and generally speaking, we try not to learn a lot of them. Or if you do, I've learned some languages. I speak French and so on. I live in Montreal. But like, it's very challenging. It's taken me years, and I'm still not as good at French as somebody who grew up speaking it. And yet, in a few short years and a few short months, people picked up emoji so quickly, which is just not how you pick up languages at all. And the reason they were able to pick it up so quickly is because in many cases, the emoji had a direct gestural correlate. You know, if you send someone a thumbs up emoji, like that means pretty much the same as sending them a thumbs up gesture. So you don't really need to learn anything new. Or if you send someone a birthday cake emoji, you know what a birthday cake means and you can just put the birthday cake. And even in the cases where the emoji had meanings that aren't necessarily completely obvious. So there's been some confusion. There is some confusion among some people around the face with tears of joy, the crying laughing emoji versus the loudly sobbing emoji. So sometimes you get people who are, you know, use one for positive situations when it's actually intended for negative situations or vice versa. Even that's just one thing that needs to be explained to you. Or even if you need to have explained to you what the eggplant stands for, that's just one thing. You don't have to learn a whole grammar. You don't have, and even if you're not using emoji exactly the same way as the kids are, you can still kind of convey something with emoji. Whereas, you know, it takes years to become fluent in a language. Like, they'd be way more inefficient.
Yeah. So I guess you don't know. You have no sense of, obviously, you can't predict what the future of emoji is going to be. But you do say we're probably still going to want some kind of digital embodiment of a gesture somehow.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look at emoji as coming out of this earlier situation where we had plain text emoticons, you know, things like colon, hyphen, parenthesis, and that whole family, because those have been around since the 80s, the 1980s, which makes them, you know, like 30, 40 years old. Which is a long time in internet speak. Like, we didn't have touch screens in the 80s. We didn't have a mouse in the 80s. and yet here are these plain text emoticons that have survived, which suggests they're doing something useful. And the only thing that really starts dethroning, and doesn't even completely dethrone, but starts dethroning the plain text emoticons, is when you now have these colorful emoji that can take on some of the same pragmatic functions. And so I think if there are other things, you know, some people really like the Bitmoji or the Memoji or the sort of like larger sticker version of emoji that you can't really copy and paste them the same way within a line of text because they're sent more like images. But you do have a bigger space to sort of play on for the visual part. You know, these, so something like this or something that hasn't been invented yet could be part of this sort of, you know, where does this visual expression go? Where does this way of expressing our gestures end up? I'm open to emoji may seem dated the way that plain text emoticons now seem a bit old school. But I think that this whole section of things, I don't think that we would have, you know, reduced our frequency of using plain text emoticons if we hadn't had something like emoji that fulfilled a similar function and did some parts of that better. Because, like, I don't know how you do a birthday cake in plain text emoticons. So this sort of thing of, you know, how can we more fully express the whole part of the message, which includes not just the words, but also the tone and the gestures and so on that go with it, whether that's with emoji or whether that's with some sort of new tool that eventually gets invented, I'm open to suggestion here. But it seems like if you don't have something in those veins, you find it difficult.
I want to ask you about the punctuation, in particular the period. It's something you write about. You've mentioned that the period is now open and available for taking on other sorts of meanings and other connotations. That's how you've put it. So when a person from a certain generation puts a period at the end of their text, a person from another generation sees that and interprets that as tone, something impatient or passive-aggressive or even hostile. What's going on there?
Right. So there's a couple steps that happen in this interaction. The one thing, the first question is, what do we think of as a default, right? What do you think of as the default way of ending an utterance? And in a paper context, the default way of ending an utterance is a period, because a period is very space efficient when it comes to paper. But in a digital context, you don't need to be that efficient with space. And you already have this sort of built-in thing that gets you a break between utterances. And that's the new message. So every time you send a new message, that's your new utterance. And in a chat context, you want those new utterances to be fairly short, because if you wanted a long utterance, that's more like sending an email. You know, that's a whole message. Because the default has shifted, and so if your norms are predicated on chat, or if you developed your internet communication norms thinking about them in terms of chat rather than thinking about them in terms of email or in terms of letters or in terms of longer form, you know, paper-based or large text box communication versus kind of small text box communication, then you're thinking of the default in terms of new message. And anything that people do that seems like non-default behavior has the potential to communicate a message. And this is true in speech as well. So if you say, would you mind opening the window instead of open the window, you're conveying that you're trying to be polite. And in this case, adding that extra period, so that's conveying something extra. And then the question is, what is that extra thing that the period is conveying? And that's where you have to look at sort of the context of what else the period does. So the period conventionally ends a sentence. It's associated with formal writing. And if you think about how you read a formal sentence in a formal context, you're often sort of putting your intonation down at the end of every sentence. But it turns out that when you take a positive message, like, okay, and you say that with this sort of downwards curving intonation, okay, ooh, now you get this sort of passive-aggressive feeling to it. Because saying it with that sense of finality or that sense of downwards intonation adds this note of cognitive dissonance between the positivity of the message and the solemnity or the seriousness or the formality or the downwards intonation of the punctuation. And this isn't true for all messages. So if you say something like, that sounds terrible, and you say it with that downwards intonation and with that period, that's not passive aggressive. That's just extra serious, because those two things are congruous now. It's the incongruity of a positive message and a formal or serious punctuation mark that ends up creating passive aggressive. So it's not that the period is always passive aggressive. It's that in certain contexts, it ends up getting read as passive aggressive because of this incongruity.
It's all about the context. And you mentioned that, so the older generation may get frustrated when a younger person reads that text, reads that period as passive aggressive. But you say we can't help it. The younger generation is going to intuit tone from that. That's just the way it is. This is how language works. So the older generation needs to just get over it because this is where we are,
well,
I suppose.
I think there are two things there, because any communication takes two sides. On the one hand, it's really hard to not infer tone. Like, if you try to tell somebody, oh, you know, I always sound like I'm angry, but like, I'm not actually angry at you. Just like, don't interpret me in a spoken context as if I'm angry. That's just how I talk. You can try to tell people that. But ultimately, we're pretty good at interpreting tone. We're pretty active at interpreting tone in speech. And it's really hard to turn that sort of thing off. That being said, I think that this can come on multiple sides, because I've heard from younger people who say, oh, I thought this person just hated me, but it turns out they were actually old. Like, now I can understand. Like, if I know that it's just this person's thing or it's just this generation's thing, I can kind of add that sort of additional conscious layer on top of that. So, you know, if you're communicating with somebody and you really want to make sure you're not being taken as passive aggressive, it might be a useful idea to say, yeah, you know, maybe you don't want to use the period in that context. But if you're communicating with someone who ends every single message with a period, it could be equally useful to say, maybe they're not trying to be passive aggressive every single sentence. You know, there's both of those can happen. But I'm reminded, you know, in the 90s, there was a big wave of like, my boss doesn't know that sending emails in all caps indicates shouting.
Yeah.
And there was a reason for that at the time, too. Like, some early computers had actually only supported all caps. And so some people got used to the idea that all caps is just how you write on a machine. So I think the period is at a similar spot of, like, you know, some people saying, like, look, the period is passive aggressive. Like, don't do it. But people are still doing it. And when it becomes, when there's more conscious awareness that there is this sort of generational difference, it's easier to at least go into that conscious level over the tone of voice and say, okay, I know this looks passive aggressive to me, but like, I also know that that's just this person's
yeah.
thing.
So where does Okay Boomer fit in all of this?
I wish Okay Boomer had been around in time for me to put it in the book, but it'll probably be dated in a year or two anyway. So maybe it's good that I didn't put it in. But I think what's interesting about this style is it's part of the way that, you know, this older generation, whether they're specifically baby boomers or whether they're sort of like larger group that gets lumped together around baby boomers, which is sometimes the case, you know, the way that those styles have become associated with a very specific genre. Like, a few years ago, when people were talking about their older friends and relatives using dot, dot, dot all the time or using these periods or so on, it seemed very much like, oh, it's just this thing that this one person that I know does. And now it's sort of taken on a larger life of, you know, here's what this whole group does and here's this thing that I associate with this whole group, even if not actually every person in that group does it, but it gets associated with that whole group. The linguistic term for this is enregistrement. So it's when a linguistic variety becomes popularly associated with a particular group, with a stereotype of a particular group. And it's not always completely accurate that you make these sorts of associations, you know, whether this is like, you know, Americans thinking that British people all sound like, oh, I want a cup of tea. And like, that's not a good British accent. But like, if you're trying to make a fake British accent, you're like, oh, look, let's have a spot of tea and go into the garden and feed the ducks. This isn't a good British accent, but it's an enregistered British accent because it reads as British to people who aren't British.
Right.
It codes this sort of thing that's popularly associated with Britishness, even though it wouldn't actually fool anybody. So associating these particular stylistic features with boomers, whether or not they're accurate for all boomers, is part of sort of enregistering that genre as well. And I think it's really interesting because young people's speech gets enregistered all the time. So we think about those, you know, those acronyms or those emoji parodies that have like way too many acronyms and way too many emoji and aren't actually how young people talk. That's an enregistered version of what young people's internet writing actually looks like. And so the idea that we can kind of do this in return to an older generation and produce this sort of stylized or parodied or stereotypical version of what this generation looks like or writes like or sounds like is an interesting way of sort of pushing back against this idea that like only young people have a marked way of talking.
You say in the book that in the past, when we have thought about a metaphor for the English language, the thing that always came to mind was a book. But you say now we need a new metaphor, that the book metaphor has run its course. And the new one you have in mind, I guess, is the internet, is a network.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, those old like models of the brain that were like back in the day, it was like a steam engine. It's kind of like the brain. And now we look at that and we say, oh, how silly. You know, obviously a steam engine is like the brain because obviously the brain's like a computer.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think the brain is also completely like a computer, but, you know, there's these metaphors kind of can tend to evolve with technology. And yet we've let this sort of same metaphor of like, oh, the English language, it must be contained in the dictionary. It must be contained in the encyclopedia. It must be contained in a sufficiently large library. And that makes us think that, you know, if you go into a library and you start writing on the margins of the books, you're going to get in some trouble because the idea of a library is that, you know, there's a certain sort of version of the language that has control or that has power or that's enshrined in this sort of historical sense. And then, you know, the ordinary person is the sort of anarchist that comes in and alters it. But when you think of language as a network, you know, you don't expect when you put a book down and you come back to it tomorrow, you expect it to be the same when it's changed. But when you leave the internet overnight and you come back to it in the morning, you don't expect it to be the same as the way you left it. You know, sometimes there's been like a whole meme that you missed. You're like, why is everyone talking about hogs now? You know, sometimes there's been news, there's been a meme, there's been something that goes on. And if you leave the internet for a couple of days, like, of course stuff has happened. And if you leave language alone or if you, like, language is, if a group of your friends are talking, you get up and go to the bathroom and you come back 5 minutes later, you don't expect the conversation to be exactly where you left it, because they're going to keep changing it because they're alive and they're not going to sit there in silence like waiting for you to come back like they put the movie on pause and nobody talked because not everybody was there. We don't expect that to be how living things work. You know, if you leave your dog for the day, your dog still does stuff. Sometimes not great stuff. So when a book is dead. You know, a book can remind us of living people, but it is not a living thing itself. It doesn't change, you know, except to kind of gradually decay. And that's where people think of, you know, language as ruining or language as decaying, because a book can decay. But when you leave living things alone, they do stuff. And that stuff is interesting and it's natural and it's of course it's going to happen. You don't just, you know, like people aren't just going to stop doing stuff because you stopped paying attention to them. And so language keeps changing, regardless of our own personal involvement or lack of involvement in it, because it exists between and among and within people who are alive, and living things change. And that can be very exciting, because a network isn't made worse as it changes. When you grow new connections in that network, you add new things to that network, that makes it stronger. That makes it more interesting. That's what keeps it alive, rather than just being the same sort of outdated thing. And so I think thinking of the changeability of language as part of its strength, rather than as some sort of ruining thing, can make us more relaxed and make us more excited about this. It's really nice to know that in a world where there are lots of real things to worry about, language change is just not one of them.
That's Gretchen McCulloch. She's an internet linguist. Her new book is called Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. She joined us from her home in Montreal. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Thanks to our intern, Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ale Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.